right of birth. And you wouldn't close the land all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain with our sweat.
You're listening to Corporations and Democracy. In the second half of today's program, we're going to look at some history related to the recent, very public controversy over the confirmation of nominee Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court. Turns out this was nowhere near the first or most contentious confirmation battle for a Supreme Court justice. And the only news item I saw that put this conflict into perspective was written by our second guest today. That article was titled, "On the Supreme Court, Difficult Nominations Have Led to Historical Injustices." And its author is Calvin Schermerhorn, professor of history at Arizona State University, where he is the associate director for undergraduate studies in the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies. Professor Schermerhorn is a historian of slavery, capitalism, and African-American inequality, for which he has written three books: The Business of Slavery and the Rise of American Capitalism, 1815 to 1860, Money Over Mastery, Family Over Freedom, Slavery in the Antebellum Upper South, and most recently, Unrequited Toil, A History of United States Slavery. He's been at Arizona State since 2008, after earning a doctorate in history from the University of Virginia. Before that, he worked in marketing in New Jersey and in family support on an Air Force base in Washington, D.C. So let's look at some historic injustices from politicized Supreme Court nominations. Calvin Schermerhorn, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
So as Steve was talking about, and we're interested in your article, the nation is reeling from controversial court nomination. We've just been riveted to our TV sets, watching every little unfolding. It's easy to forget that this has happened before. There's been other miscarriages of Supreme Court justices. There's also Merrick Garland was an issue of a failure to support a Supreme Court. Can you give us a little sense of what the history is, that it's not just what we're seeing now, that this is, there have been problems all along?
Yes. If we go back, way back to the start of the American Republic in the 1790s, you had the Federalists who were interested in centralizing government, and they had their day, and at the end of the 1790s, they lost public opinion. They became very unpopular. And it was from about that time, from about the election of 1800, when Thomas Jefferson was elected president, or some say selected president, because it went into the House of Representatives, the court became a big contentious issue. And after it was clear to the Federalists that the Jefferson party was winning, they tried to pack the federal judiciary, so much so that they created a huge backlash among voters. There was a John Randolph of Roanoke said that the federal judiciary was a hospital for decayed politicians. And sure enough, the Federalists packed the courts with enough like-minded people that the federal judiciary was shaped over the next generation and a half by Federalists. Chief among them was Chief Justice John Marshall, a Federalist of Virginia, who was essentially the key architect of the Supreme Court as we know it. That is a branch of government that made itself politically useful as it asserted its power over the constitutionality of laws and of making sure that the centralizing process that the Federalists had started was going to continue under Democratic, Republican, or Jeffersonian administrations. So the court's been politicized for a long, long time.
When you mentioned packing the court, now, is that when the court first went to nine, or was it after that? I've forgotten a little history there.
It was. So the court was not at nine. Well, the court fluctuated. And so way back in the early Republic, the court had six. You'd say, why six? Well, they needed a supermajority to render a decision. Mm-hmm. Federalists tried to reduce it to five after it was clear they lost. The Jefferson people raised it to six and then seven, mm-hmm. and then nine in 1837, 10 in 1863 with the addition of the 10th Circuit west of the Mississippi, mm-hmm. was reduced back to seven in 1866, then up to nine in 1869, when it was clear the Grant administration needed more friendly justices. And that stayed at nine ever since. And the one exception, or possible exception, was during the Franklin Roosevelt administration, when Roosevelt decided he needed a more friendly Supreme Court and tried to pack the court with 15 justices. But that was a little bit too much of an overreach.
Well, I didn't know that.
Here are signs that the Supreme Court is not a neutral body, but it is an extension of a president's political strategy when the president nominates someone to the Supreme Court, and the composition of the court in terms of their political allegiances usually shapes how the court's decisions unfold in its cases.
We're getting a little bit of interference. It sounds like you're in a windstorm, but I guess there's nothing. There's no fan near you or anything.
No, I'm sorry. I'm talking to you from a high point on, above Santa Fe, and I'll try and get out of the wind, but this is just about the only place where my cell service works.
Okay, well, we'll take the wind then, because we can actually hear what you're saying pretty well.
So. Actually, yeah, that comment right there was crystal clear. So anyway, let's continue with this.
Good.
So one of the things is his lifetime appointments. They were supposed to protect the Supreme Court justices from political pressure, but now it's sort of looking like that's a joke.
Yeah, so the lifetime appointment insulating the justices from political pressure is a bit of a red herring, because the justices, it's not like it's a dialogue out of Plato, where the Supreme Court is staffed by the people who are rendered most just or the people who are most deserving or something like that. From the start, the Supreme Court has been composed of people who share a similar point of view to those who are appointing them. And so the fact that they don't submit to re-election or to election at all doesn't mean that they're not political and doesn't mean that they're not they don't take part in partisan feuds. And so we saw this in the early 19th century in the court of Roger B. Taney of Maryland. So Taney was a partisan warrior who was a staunch loyalist to Andrew Jackson. When Andrew Jackson wanted to illegally destroy the Second Bank of the United States, he called on Taney after two secretaries of the Treasury refused to do it. Taney helped illegally drain the funds, killed the monster bank, and Jackson waited. Well, he tried to appoint him Secretary of the Treasury. Congress refused to endorse him and actually censured Jackson for killing the bank. And then Jackson waited till after the next election, put Taney up for a Supreme Court vacancy. And then when Justice John Marshall died in 1834, Jackson put him up for, I believe it's 1834, put Taney up for the Chief Justice of the United States. And Taney remained Chief Justice until 1864. And his court was staunchly pro-slavery. That is, whenever a question of slavery came before the court, and Taney picked the cases, as every chief justice does, the court would rule in favor of enslavers' interests. And this was most conspicuously on display in the 1857 case Dred Scott v. Sanford. Dred Scott was enslaved, but he was taken to free territory by an owner. He was eventually sued in Missouri. A Missouri state court said, okay, sounds good. You can have your freedom. And this was challenged, and the Supreme Court took it on appeal. Judge Taney wrote a majority decision and ruled that Dred Scott did not actually have standing to sue because he was not a citizen. And then Taney took the opportunity to go much further, and he said he ruled that the Missouri Compromise, granting Congress the power to regulate slavery in the territories, was null. It had been repealed already, but this was a nail in the coffin.
That was 1850s-ish there?
Taney.
1850s yes. For that, is that right? Okay.
Yes, 1857.
Okay.
And then Taney ruled that no person of African descent can actually be considered a citizen, using an originalist doctrine that went back to the Declaration of Independence and the framers of the Constitution, saying that they had never envisioned African Americans to be citizens. And he said that African Americans have no rights which the white man are bound to respect, and they may be reduced to slavery for their own benefit. I'm paraphrasing the ruling.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can see how a politicized justice rendered a politically convenient decision for pro-slavery interests in 1857.
Considered probably the worst decision in the history of the Supreme Court.
The worst decision in the history of the Supreme Court, yes, but it stood until the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, mm-hmm. which granted all citizens equal protection of the laws, at least in theory, and swept away the Dred Scott decision. It wasn't the only pro-slavery decision that Taney rendered, but it was certainly the most famous and had the farthest reaching effect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're lucky to have you on because you have a lot of work you've done on the history of slavery, and it also, unfortunately, follows along with the Supreme Court, and including even Abraham Lincoln, who was supposed to set people free. You want to talk about that?
Yes, so this is a very interesting case of a president who selected Supreme Court nominees for a particular purpose that ended up undermining the larger purpose of the Civil War. So Abraham Lincoln was able to replace the Taney Court with Republicans who are very interested in supporting his powers as the president to conduct the Civil War. And secondarily, he appointed justices who were friendly to corporations. Lincoln was a corporation lawyer. And as the United States economy changed and became, you know, kind of a gilded age of corporations, the Republican Party wanted to keep up and have corporation-friendly lawyers. And so one of Lincoln's first appointments was Henry Miller, who is from Iowa. And Miller was appointed because he was likely, you know, a political friend. And Lincoln appointed him in the summer of 1862 when he was considering the Emancipation Proclamation. Sorry, that was Samuel Miller, not Henry Miller. And so you think, well, if you're considering the Emancipation Proclamation, you might want to ask your nominee to the Supreme Court what they think about the scope of African-American freedom. But Lincoln, being busy at the time, simply submitted his name, didn't meet with him, and he was confirmed without debate. He was confirmed without debate because the southern wing of the Democratic Party had seceded from the Union and was off fighting for the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well and good. But this decision came back to haunt him, I guess, in 1873. Lincoln had already been assassinated. But Miller decided, in a 5-4 ruling in what was called the Slaughterhouse Cases, that confined the 14th Amendment to only protect those powers that were enumerated by the original Constitution. And if I could cut through some of that legalese, it meant that states could continue to discriminate against, let's say, African Americans by doing things that they were not expressly forbidden to do by other amendments. That may not be much clearer, but some of Lincoln's other appointments also, you know, had an adverse effect on civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
I could probably talk all day about this, but the real damage to civil rights as a result of the Civil War was done by a couple of Grant appointees. That is, Ulysses S. Grant became president in 1869,
mm-hmm.
and he appointed some, you know, Republican operatives, you might say Republican hacks, to the Supreme Court. One was Joseph P. Bradley, and the other was Morrison Waite. Morrison Waite had absolutely no judicial experience at all, but Grant and his party needed corporation-friendly lawyers, and they needed lawyers who would decide on cases involving currency that was not backed by gold or silver.
Mm-hmm.
And so Morrison Waite delivered the goods, and Bradley did as well. Bradley was appointed specifically to rule in the legal tender cases in 1874. But the real test came in an 1876 court decision, U.S. v. Cruikshank. And if I could just go back and explain what the issue was. The person named in the case was William or Bill Cruikshank, and he had taken part in a massacre of African Americans in Grant Parish, Louisiana, in 1873. And this was a political battle involving two elected governments of Louisiana, one Republican, one Democratic, one gotten through civil rights reform, the other gotten by blocking votes for African Americans. Mm-hmm. And so this was a political battle that culminated in the Colfax Massacre in Colfax, Louisiana, on the banks of the Red River. Crookshank and his fellow sheriff's posse murdered about 150 African Americans. And Crookshank even stood two black men up together to shoot them in the head with the same bullet. Mm. Now, he knew that no court in Louisiana would try him for murder, because the Redeemers, the old Confederates had come back and taken the state back over. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd lost the Civil War, but they hadn't given up on the lost cause. So the only way that Crookshank and his fellow, you know, racial terrorists, let's call them, could be prosecuted was under a federal statute. That is the Enforcement Act of 1870. They also passed the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871. And this made it a crime to violate someone's civil rights by murdering them, mm-hmm. or by terrorizing them, or by burning their house down.
Mm-hmm.
And so Crookshank and some 70 other perpetrators in the Colfax Massacre were prosecuted, and many were convicted in federal court in Louisiana. Now, Crookshank appealed his federal conviction, and his lawyers argued to the U.S. Supreme Court that the Enforcement Act of 1870 violated the Constitution. And this came up by 1876. Morrison Waite was inclined to agree, and he said that the 14th Amendment's powers did not cover discrimination by individuals, only by the state. And the only obligation resting upon the United States is to see that the states do not deny the rights of citizens. Mm-hmm. And so instead of seeing this as a political act, he said, well, this is just individual, you know, murder, and there's nothing the federal government can do about it. And this was willful blindness to the fact that it was a politically motivated mm-hmm. assault, that the Colfax Massacre was political murder. The other justice, Joseph Bradley, another Grant appointee, wrote that the United States had not clearly stated that the accused, in slaughtering more than 100 black men, had committed the acts complained of in order to deprive them of their rights. It's almost as if he said they had to shout out while they were murdering people, we are doing this in the name of depriving people of state of their civil rights.
It's so, just incredible. This is history that
a death knell for civil rights, uh-huh. and it went downhill from there.
Yeah, for another 70, whatever it was, till the late 50s, early 60s. Incredible.
Yeah. So Congress wouldn't pass a Civil Rights Act until 1957.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we think things are bad right now. Steve, you had a question about the justices during the Civil War.
Yeah, there was this is a little bit of a tangent, but you say Lincoln was trying to get, or you know, appointed this fellow in 1862, I think you said it was. But what happened to the justices from southern states during the Civil War?
So this is a good question. The Supreme Court did not do what Congress did, which was the Southern members generally went home.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court kind of hid out during the Civil War and let the Civil War proceed. That is, that the Supreme Court didn't hear a lot of cases during the Civil War, and the justices didn't secede from the court. Roger Taney of Maryland stayed Chief Justice until his death in 1864. Of course, Maryland didn't secede. Now, that didn't mean that Taney was inactive. In 1861, in a case called Ex Parte Merriman, he ruled that the president could not detain a citizen in a military detention center without asserting that he'd committed a crime. And so the background for this was that some Maryland officials were encouraging secession in 1861, mm-hmm. and that would have, I guess, surrounded Washington, D.C. by mm-hmm. Confederate states, since Virginia also seceded in 1861. And Lincoln ordered a few people detained at Fort McHenry in Baltimore Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say that they'd done anything wrong, just that they should be detained so that they didn't do anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so Justice Taney said no, he needs to issue a writ of habeas corpus. His instructions were vague. The Lincoln administration ignored the court, and there you have it. The court was rather ineffective during the war in pushing the old pro-slavery agenda, and it didn't render a lot of judgments during the war.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one very bitter battle that you've written about over Justice Louis Brandeis that actually had a good outcome.
Yes, so Justice Louis Brandeis was nominated to the Supreme Court by Woodrow Wilson in 1916. He was the first Jewish Supreme Court nominee, and this provoked a furious confirmation battle in Congress that was tinged by anti-Semitism. And if you go back and read some of the transcripts, it's really personal attacks and calling him unfaithful, fraudulent, just unfit for any court, unfit to be a lawyer. And Congress the Senate confirmed him by a very narrow majority. And Brandeis went on to be one of the most renowned justices in the Supreme Court's history, and he's known most for protecting, imagining first, and then protecting a citizen's right to privacy.
Okay, so then we had Truman as another interesting interlude here in the history of the Supreme Court nominees. Truman made a surprise appointment that you thought served justice ultimately.
Yeah, so in 1945, there was a vacancy on the court. Truman nominated his good friend Harold H. Burton. Truman was a Democrat. Harold H. Burton was a sitting U.S. Senator from Ohio and a Republican. Truman did this. The reaction was very muted, the Senate decided to dispense with any hearings, moved it straight from the Judiciary Committee to the full Senate, dispense with any floor debates, and he was confirmed within hours. absolutely no vetting of his record. But Burton went on to rule in Brown versus Board of Education. He actually shaped the Brown versus Board of Education decision. He didn't write the majority opinion that dispensed with the separate but equal doctrine that had reigned since 1896. And decided that school segregation was unconstitutional. Segregation by race was unconstitutional. So here is a Republican who is thinly vetted or not vetted at all, confirmed in haste, who went on to protect individual civil rights. What we should keep in mind is that cases like Brown v. Board of Education are very rare in the history of the Supreme Court. That is that those victories that we celebrate are few and far between.
Uh-huh. So right now with the Kavanaugh commotion, a lot of people are talking about Clarence Thomas, that's kind of an echo of that. Maybe it was more vulgar than assault, but that people are drawing some comparisons. Do you want to talk about 1991?
Yeah, so 1991, George H.W. Bush nominated Clarence Thomas. He was not Bush's first choice, there was a surprise vacancy, and Thomas was picked because he was a partisan warrior. He didn't have a very long judicial record, and he was reliably conservative, and so he was pushed through the nomination process hastily. Of course, it blew up into the hearings of his alleged sexual harassment. Confirmation and what the Thomas nomination tells us is that this was an era of transition, the presidents were going to nominate people who had very reliably partisan credentials rather than someone like Burton, who was the sitting senator from Ohio. So the Thomas nomination proved to deliver the goods for those who nominated him. Thomas has been consistently conservative. He ruled with the majority in Shelby County versus Holder, which gutted portions of the Civil Rights Act, or the Voting Rights Act of 1965. He ruled with the thin majority, the 5-4 majority in Bush v. Gore, to stop the Florida recount and essentially push the 2000 presidential election in the direction of George W. Bush, the son of the man who nominated him. He was with the majority in Citizens United versus the Election Commission, which equated dollars with the civil rights of free speech. And he was also in the very recent decision authored by Neil Gorsuch in Epic Systems Corp. v. Lewis. And this actually guts Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, weakens, if not nullifies, the National Labor Relations Act of 1935 by allowing an employer, as a condition of employment, to put courts off limits to employees who are seeking to redress claims of wage or other kind of discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
So these, you know, we think about the Supreme Court usually in terms of those big decisions like Brown v. Board of Education or Loving v. Virginia that struck down interracial marriage laws.
Mm-hmm.
But the business of the court over the last 13 years of the Chief Justice John Roberts has very much, you know, shielded the prerogatives of corporations,
mm-hmm.
Of the wealthy. And these decisions tend not to advance civil rights. In fact, they roll back civil rights gains of the 1960s.
Well, we need to leave it there. This has been one heck of a fast half hour, but thank you for being with us, Professor Calvin Schermerhorn, and that's Schermerhorn, Professor of History at Arizona State University. This is great stuff. Thanks for being our guest today.
Yes, thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. You've been listening to Corporations and Democracy, broadcast on 2nd and 4th Fridays here at 11 o'clock on KCYX and Z. We'll be back in 2 weeks with Coast Linda McClure, and I will return on November 9th. And for further information about these issues, you can go to thealliancefordemocracy.org.
I write up first.